Hi, and welcome to the Profit Tool Belt podcast, just for business owners in construction and contracting. My name is Dominic Rubino, and I'll be your host. On this podcast, we're going to learn about the business of the construction business. For too long, people have been keeping secrets, the secrets of how to run a construction business like a business. Well, no more. If you're worried that you didn't go to business school and yet you're still running a company, but you also find you have a lot of questions, then you're not alone. And I think you're going to love this. Because if you have questions about the mindset of success, if you're curious about time and time management, if you wonder how others are managing and motivating their people, if you want to learn the inside tips on money and profitability, and if you have questions about marketing and sales and running this business, so you not only make money, but you also have a life, then welcome. Those are the questions this podcast is here to answer. Let's get to it. Here's an interesting fact about money. Did you know the copper content of US pennies has been going down since they started making the things? Yeah, the first pennies were pure, like 100% copper. But today, a 1 cent coin is made from 95% zinc, and it's then just coated in copper. And hey, you might not know this, but in Canada, they don't even make the penny anymore. Anyways, money's always on people's minds. If you're trying to find ways to make it easier for your clients to pay you for your services, then you should check out gethearth.com/PTB. Hearth is a financing company that lets contractors and tradespeople like us offer financing for their work. So think about pools, HVAC units, roofing, kitchen and bath renovations, cabinetry, you name it. If you want to learn more about how you can offer financing to your clients in the field using their simple three-step process, go to gethearth.com/PTB. Or, as you know, you can always just send a text message to me at 604-837-8361 and just say financing option, and I'll send you the info you're looking for. Hey everyone, welcome to the Profit Tool Belt podcast. I'm glad to have you here. Today we're going to be talking to Gerald Olesker. Now, Gerald is not a guy you would normally meet. He does specialty lighting. He's an architect, but he also runs his own fabrication shop where he does glass, metal, and I'm sure some electrical stuff in there as well. I found him through some connections. He's an interesting guy that most people would never talk to. And he does lighting for the wealthy beyond the wealthy. Wealthy. And the reason I have him on here is because we always want to know how the wealthy live. But I really want to find out more about, well, the question of today is, can I afford to do work for wealthy clients? And that goes for you and I, no matter what market we're in. If you are in the most remote part of Nevada, you still have some wealthy clients. If you're in the remotest part of Florida, you still have some wealthy clients. It doesn't matter where you are in Ottawa or in Sydney, there's wealthy clients. It doesn't just have to be in Beverly Hills where Gerald's based out of. So let's think about that as we go into this episode. He's built a very successful, very niche, specialized business in that market. Hey, while we're talking about markets, you should think about joining the Contractor Strategy Group if you already haven't. It's on Facebook. It's a free group, but that doesn't mean it's cheap. You have to answer a couple of questions to get in. It's only for business owners. And the question of today was asked by somebody out of Australia, where he's asking a question on websites and Facebook pages and how to advertise on there. And oh my God, he blew up the internet. I mean, he didn't blow up the internet. Just blew up the website there. There's a ton of interest, people going back and forth. And I think what you might appreciate the most is there's no salespeople floating around this conversation. It's just contractors talking to other contractors. You got a roofing guy answering, a cabinetry guy, somebody else that does landscape. Like, there's a whole bunch of people in there talking about it from the owner's perspective. And so I think if you appreciate that kind of stuff, please keep in mind this group on Facebook is not a time-wasting group. We're here to exchange information at the business owner level. It's networking with like-minded people, other people that are facing forward in their business that want to know what's up. So come and join us in that group. Just apply to get in and we'll watch for you. By the way, Dan Zambello, I've asked Dan to now help me administer that account because it's so busy. So much is going on. Dan is a contractor himself, and he was actually a member of the group. Some of you will recognize his name. And I just always saw great comments and insights from him. And so I reached out and asked him if he could help me administer it. And here we are today. Anyways, a big thanks to Dan Zambello on that. All right, folks, listen, let's get to the episode and we'll talk to you on the other side. Hey, let's start off this episode with a nice juicy joke. So there's a guy named George. George lives right on the water, on the coast in Oregon. Those of you who've been to Oregon know it's beautiful. It doesn't matter what direction you look. It's a pretty stunning place, right? Anyways, he lives in Oregon and he loves traveling. He loves his RV, but he's also dreaming of going to Hawaii. Anyways, one day he's out beachcombing. Beachcombing is where you're walking around on the beach. You're kicking logs and you're turning over things and you find stuff that is washed up from other places. Anyways, George stumbles over a magic lamp. There's a genie inside, and that genie is going to grant him a single wish. This is a cheap genie. This is a budget genie. They must have granted the other two wishes to somebody else. Anyways, the genie said, George says to the genie, "Hey, listen, I've always wanted to explore the island of Maui in my motorhome, but I can't afford to ship it there. My wish is for you to build a bridge from Oregon to Hawaii so I can fulfill my dream." The genie looks up and he scratches his genie chin and he says, "That, sir, is impossible. The ocean is far too deep to build a bridge across. Even a genie powerful such as I cannot do it. You must wish for something else." George thinks for a second. He says, "I don't really understand women. I wish to understand how they think and what they want." And the genie, without skipping a beat, says, "Sir, do you want 2 lanes or 4 on that bridge?" Listen, if you like stories like this, I'm going to tell you real stories at the end of the episode. We've got a segment called Storytime with Dom. Now, I tell a lot of jokes that involve guys. We have men and women listening to this show. We actually have a lot of women business owners listening. Please never be offended. I'm just sharing jokes that I've found in other places, and I'm just putting them up here. But if you like real stories from real people in real situations and how they've dealt with the challenges and the opportunities that they found in their business, you're going to love the segment called Storytime with Dom. I always put it at the very end of the episodes, and you're going to want to hear it. Today's is especially juicy. Mr. Gerald Olesker, how are you?
I am very well, Dom. Thanks.
Good to see you. Good.
Yeah. Same here. Same coast, same time.
Same coast, same time. Mutual friends and acquaintances who got me to find you, because you have to be found, man.
I'm Googleable.
You're Googleable, but you have to know you exist before people can find you. And then it took us a little bit of sorting and sifting to get to you.
Right.
Yeah. So that I don't have too much mystery here for the Profit Tool Belt crew, the people listening here, Gerald, who the heck are you? And why would you be talking to this group of entrepreneurs in the construction and trades industry on this podcast?
Probably because I'm a sucker for everything built. I'm an architectural industrial designer, author, artist, and entrepreneur. At least that's what it says on all of my emails, so I guess I have to go with that.
Yeah, just read it right off the bottom.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But that phrase was really coined because of what I do and what I've done. Started as an architect in the early 90s. Go Cal Poly, if anyone likes Cal Poly.
Great. Who's the mascot of Cal Poly? What's the Cal Poly mascot?
Those are the Broncos. But if you're at the other Cal Poly, it's the Mustangs. So, you know, screwed up there.
Yeah, it's okay. Choose your t-shirt on the day you need to wear it. Yeah.
Exactly. And no football team, so it didn't matter. You know, architects, engineers, and agricultural people. So, you know, all good. But I had gotten the lighting business by accident.
Lighting?
I was working in architecture.
Yeah.
I was trained by one of the best landscape architects in the state of California, working for Sid Galper and Cleo Baldwin. And I was one of those inquisitive young architects. I wore tool bags too in the beginning while I was working in the through school. Had to get all those intern hours, and I believe you got to know how to make things. You have to build.
What do you like making? What's your favorite thing to make, or what do you get the most satisfaction from?
Money.
I meant on the tools, but you're right. This show's not about being on the tools. I just wanted to get a perspective of how you got into high-end lights.
You know, I think the favorite thing I made was for my wife, but nice. I'll digress. It took her many years to ask me for that one piece and many years for me to finally make it. Nice. But, you know, in architecture, design, development, construction, it's really a chaotic field, especially in the upper end world. A lot going on, a lot of decision makers, a lot of passionate individuals who want their way.
So it's interesting because your sweet spot in this world is the uber wealthy, like names we can't mention.
Right. Like the 1% of the 1%.
The 1% of the 1% that everybody else looks up to and wonders, how come my yacht isn't 100 feet longer?
I actually had a conversation, I kid you not, Friday night, 9:30 p.m., drunk dialed by a client who was very upset because she's serving the board in this one particular golf club, country club, won't say what because it narrows it down too much because this is a small world. And she said, look, I'm not the rich one on the board. Everyone else has their own plane, but let me tell you what I need. And kept going and going and going. And we've only been trying to get this stuff done for, you know, the last year on this project. We had done stuff at the club and this is a new phase, but it was very funny because those are really wealthy people problems that one didn't have a plane and was upset that the other ones did. And I should understand. And I said, I do. I don't know.
That she still has needs. That she still has needs too, even though she doesn't have an airplane with a tail number to tell you when she's flying in.
Yeah. No, the only plane I have is in the shop.
Yeah, plane. For those of you who can't see the video, Gerald's making the international signal for a hand plane.
I just remembered. Right,
two-handed push.
Podcast, not a video log. Right.
Yeah, yeah. So you do, but you do lighting. I mean, how did you go from landscape design to really quite stunning lighting? How did you get there?
Early on, I use this story many times over. Cleo Baldwin had politely scolded me when I said, hey, Cleo, I don't get it. How does a designer work in architecture? And, you know, how do you guys do what you do? And you're just a designer. So here I'm being a snotty mouth 22-year-old at the time.
Yeah.
And she takes me by the hand. She says, honey, you just don't get it. And she would yell at everyone else in the office. Me, I got the honey part. She says, honey, space is space. You see that bush? That defines the space over there in that yard. You see the bench? That defines the area you're going to sit. Do you see how the floor pattern comes in from the outside, the brick comes into the inside as a thermal barrier and brings the heat through? That still defines the space of the inside and the outside and the transition between the two. So I took that with me in my years. When I was out promoting the architectural side of the business, because I didn't want to make $8 an hour drawing, I wanted to learn the business. So Sid taught me how to go out and deal with the uber wealthy.
Right.
And said, look, if the tree falls over, just replace it. And then you deal with the money, make everyone happy. And that was another lesson I took with me. So as I was going around in Beverly Hills to all these other homes, Malibu, Bel Air, because that was the local, you know, 1 hour drive around town.
Right.
Pasadena. $1 million home was like 2 acres back then too. So
the old days, right?
Now it's a tract house in Southern California.
Yeah.
I would have these conversations about architecture with the different contractors. I'd walk up to, as they say, the proverbial door, but it was just 2x4s and a header.
Yeah.
And start talking with the contractors to learn more about what was going on because I was inquisitive and I wanted to be a better architect. So I had to learn about architecture. And in that conversation, I would just ask, hey, do you need any light fixtures, by the way? I knew it was functional detail and part of the process. At that time, you'd go to a store, you'd buy a light.
Yeah, most people would think that's just, I mean, planning to the level of detail where you're down to the lights is it's further down the line. You know what I mean? Like you're usually thinking about the infrastructure and the mechanical systems.
Exactly. And so it was quicker and easier to have a discussion about something that was a tangible bite, right? Architecture as a whole is big. It has to be developed. You start with land, then you're dealing with infrastructure and framing and, you know, down to every other little detail. So what we would do is just involve ourselves in a conversation. And I'd ask, hey, you know, do you have any lights? You know, we're standing at this doorway. What do you mean? And I would grab, I'd grab my sketchbook, which was under my hand because it made me look official walking onto a job.
Yeah.
And I'd have, you know, my fountain pen. And I'd just start sketching because I knew that was an easy idea for people to grasp onto.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just about, let me give you some random light. It really was about the architecture, right? Architectural detail.
Yeah.
Architectural detail group. So
there's maybe your company. Yeah. The name of your company.
And so as I would develop that, we'd have a conversation like, hey, can the stonemason or, you know, who's doing your millwork on the outside of the house? Can we have a chat with them? Because what I want to do is make sure that the light fixture interfaces and integrates properly. I don't want this thing just slapped on the wall. Because I had looked at homes from a historical context or buildings like the Boston Public Library, and you look at this incredible melee of work, all these artisans, you know, the guys doing the millwork, the guys doing the metalwork, the guys doing the ceilings, the flooring, and all of these things. But all the trades used to come together back in the day. The architect would bring them together.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was done in pre-planning. Not like today where it's done last minute in
production style.
Yeah. So what we would do is we would have these discussions. Stonemason would come by and I would say, hey, can you make a special plinth for me so that it's sitting on the rusticated stone, but then this integrates? Oh, that's a great idea. You know, I'd talk to the finish carpenter. Hey, you got shiplap siding and I don't want this thing sitting on the side of the house all cattywampus. So can you build me a nice, you know, plinth, give me a routed edge, has to be just right. Here's my dimensionality of this fixture. So I'm going to hold to my tolerances, you hold to your tolerances, and let's go. So it became an interplay between the trades, and it just took off from there and LA to New York.
And that's the expectation. I mean, the title of today's show, so where we're supposed to be going, we'll see where we end up, you and I. But it's supposed to be, can you afford to do work for the wealthy? And I think we're understating the type of wealthy you deal with. And I know in our private pre-call, you mentioned in generality, some of the names that start with Prince of and Sheikh of, and I mean, we're talking about people that quite frankly, I have no idea their lives, but how did you find, like, you were in an industry, it sounds like, that exposed you to that space and you stayed in there, but how do you market to them? How do you serve that market? How do you stay relevant in that market? And is it a market for everybody?
It's not a market for everyone. Huh. I think today's world is very different than when I started. You know, I started with nothing. I had a couple fixture, you know, to show people in a sketchbook.
Yeah. And, now, and by the way, now you manufacture. You come up with a concept, the design, the sketch on paper, and then you guys
crank it out.
You make it. Yeah.
And we have our shop here in Southern California and then artisans all over the world that we deal with to bring the best of the best. But today's market is very different than when I started. Relevance today, if I had my way, the website would be one page and just say, buy my shit. I'm really good at what I do. And that's it. I have a social media manager.
Oh, you do?
Yes, we have a team that deals with the IT side. We have a senior engineer who today builds in 3D modeling using Inventor and can look at total weight loads, and we can balance an asymmetrical chandelier digitally before doing that first cut.
So there's a lot of detail behind this work that keeps you in that circle of people. And one of the things that I think I recognized, I'm going to ask you this, but I think I recognized in our pre-call is you're not afraid of your clients, are you?
No.
Because, and the reason, you know why I'm asking that, right? Is because some people will say, well, they're a really wealthy family and they asked for this, so I have to do it. But I didn't get that from you when we did our
it's okay to say no.
Even to these people are used to hearing yes. They're not used to hearing no. So tell us a bit about that, Gerald.
Look, the bottom of our flow chart says happy client. It doesn't say bitchin' lights. It doesn't say fine furniture. It says happy client.
Mm.
And the reason it says happy client is that's what we strive for. And the dialogue that I get to have,
yeah,
I don't think any other lighting company does, but I get to have, is as that artist, as that architectural industrial designer, as the person with the track record and success, and I can go into that later and be a little braggadocious if you want, but yeah, the reality is understanding architecture is the key element. I had a client recently who came to me. The interior designer is Timothy Corrigan, and anyone who follows or understands Tim knows about Chateau Chevalry, which is his restored chateau in France that he's working on, that basically is like another Versailles. It's phenomenal.
Oh,
his own personal chateau. And I was told about a particular client who I can't say because I have an NDA on it. And she purchased this home in a very secluded, gates behind gates, Beverly Hills location. Okay. Now in this gated community, 20 some odd years ago, I had done 24 of these homes.
24 of the homes inside this gated
community. Inside this gated community. There's 60 homes total. Okay. I've done 24 to date. And that was early on in my career. The total value of those 24 homes, I added it up the other day because I was curious, is $658 million in 24 homes.
And this, we're talking about the lighting fixtures.
Well, yes, I designed and developed the light fixtures and some furniture for these wow. particular homes, and a wonderful wealth of names. And well, today I'm working on a home for this designer in there, and this was one of those homes that got away from me.
How do you mean? What do you mean it got
away from you? 25 plus years ago, it was one of the homes that was being built and I wanted to work on it.
Ah, you didn't get it.
And then I approached them and said, I'd like to work on it, because I would just go house to house to house. And my means to gaining access to these projects were, I was very good at what I did. But to gain entree into this community, just to get through the gates, you already had to be in the know.
I was going to say, because you can't just get through the gate. There's somebody there.
No.
But you get in with the first job, I would imagine, and then you just stay in there and wander.
I got in with the first job. The gentleman who was the developer of this area, Brian Adler. Brian had taken this essentially ravine that in the 1960s was going to be a posh place for the Teamsters. And then it was going to be for celebrities. And then, and then, and then. So Brian redeveloped it into two plus acre pads. And I had an opportunity, a relationship that I knew that introduced me to Brian. And wow. He's like, kid, come on in. But only because I was really good at what I did, not because of the nepotism. The nepotism for 30 seconds got me in the door. That was it.
Sure, sure.
I wouldn't have lasted one house if I didn't.
If you weren't able to provide the quality.
Right.
Yeah.
Happy clients. So fast forward to today, this homeowner said, hey, can you make either of these two lights, and shows me a picture. And I said, I can make them. I won't make them.
So. And remember, these are people who are used to hearing yes.
Yes, exactly. And
so you can make them, but you won't make them. I don't understand. Make them.
And the question was, why won't you make them? Well, one is, you know, Prince so-and-so's home three doors away from you. And the other one is this other developer who has developed, you know, a large portion of the San Fernando Valley. And I said, I'm not going to do that because I made the, you know, fixtures for them. And I had worked with Bill Hoblinski very closely to, you know, design and create these pieces. And that's the way it works. And so we created a hybrid or a composite. And then
created something better. You created something better, more custom,
something unique to this estate. And I just got my set of red lights yesterday on them. But you know, we don't take that as anything other than the client wants to interject their opinion, and we're appreciative of that. And then we'll fine tune the red line.
Sure. So, we'll fine tune. So you must have a gajillion stories, but as you said, you can't actually tell them because it's a closed community. And part of that wealthy community is the respect for confidentiality. But what I actually heard in what you're talking about is you view what you make as intellectual property.
We do.
Very cool.
My IP attorney will argue that one all day long as well, as we're in a few entanglements because of that.
I bet you are, yeah.
But we can be inspired by others. And it's not just the inspiration of product. I mean, I look at it, and you know, my favorite architect is Louis Kahn. But you know, that's more of a hard-edged, modern, you know, architecture, concrete built. So integration and understanding how to integrate what we do into structure like that versus Paul Williams or G.W. Smith as you know, well-known architects of the day who played to the celebrity audience as well all over the country. We learn to dial in and ink like them. So it's not so much, here's the Gerald Olesker original, here's the ADG piece. It's what is the need of the architecture and understanding the influence of the architecture and current architects who will design and create these beautiful estates gives us the opportunity to collaborate at a very high level.
So what I want to do is make sure that you pass on some of your wisdom and your experience to people who are in different markets, geographic markets, you know, somebody who's in outside of Ottawa, or somebody who's in the middle of Nebraska, or somebody who's in Oregon, who doesn't have necessarily these uber, super, super wealthy people, but still has a higher end market.
Absolutely.
They want to go after. How do I make my company look so that they want to do business with me? What do they require from you so that they trust you?
That's a great question. You know, scalability and transferability is really very important. And I'll give you right now the hashtag, what we call the ADG advantage. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you what that hashtag is about. But the sideline story is, how did I learn to scale what we do? And how did I learn to control the chaos of design? And many years ago, when I was in a group called EO, Entrepreneurs Organization.
That's how you and I know each other. Yeah.
Exactly. We had our forum, which was, our forum was 10 men in various businesses. No one was in the same business, nothing repeatable. And right. It could be men and women, all men, whatever it was. Our forum happened to be all men, very successful, ranging in small businesses from a couple million to 100 million.
Right.
And one of the guys in my forum was a criminal defense attorney. And you're going to say, what the heck does criminal defense have to do with architecture, has to do with the trades, has to do with design and development and building and land use? And he had a really great set of metrics. He said, you have to keep your eye on these metrics.
I love it. So even a criminal defense attorney says you got to keep your eye on the numbers.
Yeah. Well, he had 400 attorneys working for him all over the country. And he was formerly Johnny Cochran's partner. So it sets the stage very differently. But when you have the ability to have this dialogue and you're in a group with a gentleman like that and someone else who's taken his business from, you know, several million all the way up to 100 million and then exited, you see a very different level of what you do as a craftsperson, as a maker. And what I realized is that set of information was transferable to what I do, but what I do is transferable to the carpenter,
right?
The millwork guy, the flooring guy, the you know, person doing Venetian plaster, the stonemason.
Yeah.
All of the other individual trades, as well as the contractor. And, you know, as far as contractors go, again, it's the same thing. When you have the opportunity to work with certain contractors and learn from them, like a Corbin Reeves or a McCoy Construction or someone of that essence that is working with these large homes, you have to know how to balance those needs.
Mm.
All right.
Can I ask you a question then?
Yes.
So would you prefer to deal with a business person who happens to be a contractor or a contractor with a crew of guys?
Tough. I want to deal with good people. And part of the reason why I said like Corbin Reeves and McCoy, like Mike Reeves is a gentleman. He's a business guy. He's gone through the ups and downs, sideline note, you know, if he was sitting in Forum, you totally get him. Right.
Yeah. Because
we all have these same issues.
But Forum has confidentiality, which I respect. You notice I'm not probing on that at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So as we go through that, you know, is the business guy the better person to deal with, or is the person with the skill set of hands-on tooling the better person to deal with? And what I'll tell you is both of them can be great and both of them can be awful. The better person to deal with is the one that's willing to listen to the other experts.
Oh.
So what we say with hashtag ADG Advantage is the ADG Advantage is elevating the essence of architecture through design and fabrication of lighting and furnishings with our collections through the centuries.
Mm.
Now, elevating the essence of architecture is the first part. If we all have the same goal in mind,
yeah,
everyone's going to rise together. Now, someone can say, well, I don't want to do this because it doesn't fit in my budget. Well, what doesn't fit in your budget is just a mental state. It's not a state of architecture. What can we do to make that work within your budget and let me reconfigure to make it work so that the architecture is better is why my work is shown in 20 plus books, is why I got very excited when I saw the Architectural Digest article of Aaron Paul's home that I didn't even know we were in. And Jake Arnold, the designer, had made sure we were in it because we did just that. And Jake is amazing. We elevated the essence of architecture as a project in Idaho, right?
Wow, yeah.
Never stepped foot on the project. I did it all, you know, via my desk, which we do most things today, even though we're expanding and putting people in 14 different markets right now because we're so busy and we need boots on the ground.
Yeah.
But that microcosm is transferable. But the better contractor is not the one who has the business skill or the hands-on skill. It's the one who listens to those that can make him or her look better because we're elevating the essence of architecture.
So it's about working with people who are willing to listen to the other smart people around them.
That's the only reason I'm where I'm at, because I have people way smarter than me, business consultants and accountants and lawyers. And you're like, what does that have to do with design? I'm like, look, I'm good at what I do. And there are people who are better than me at design. And there are people that are better than me at business. But I have the unique opportunity to leverage a portfolio of 2,000 plus projects worldwide.
Yeah.
Okay? 2,000 plus projects worldwide. I've been in over 200 magazines with our work showing. And those are part of our metrics, because that means I have 7,200 people in my database that we have met over the last 27 plus years now.
Yeah.
And each one of those people had something to say, whether they scolded me or they praised me, they had something to say. And that is why ADG Lighting Architectural Detail Group is where it is at today, because I had the unique advantage of working with those people, but that's still transferable to a $500,000 home.
Yeah.
Deserves something beautiful. A $200,000 home deserves something beautiful. In my world, there's just more commas and zeros. So I'm working on $50 million homes, $20 million homes that say the same thing as everyone else. Well, I don't have the budget. I'm like, you do have the budget.
Yeah. Well, what I like about the way you said that is you actually were quoting in, you probably know the book, The E-Myth Revisited,
yes,
where Gerber talks, and you did the same question, the entrepreneur question, which always starts with, how can I?
Right.
So don't say I don't have the budget. How can I have the budget? How can I make the most of what I've got with what I've got? And I think that's probably one of the takeaways I'm getting from here today is it doesn't matter if I'm doing, building sheds for somebody in their backyard or building their cottage property that's worth $3 million on a private island on a secluded lake.
Exactly.
It's just the market you've got is the one you've got, but be the person who's willing to listen and is
exactly
open to working with.
Those are what we call the six W's in the office.
What's that? What are the six W's?
So here's a takeaway, right? Who, what, how, why, when, where, and how has a W. It's just at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. If you go into each project and you ask those questions, you're going to get the answer versus coming in and telling them this is what you need. First, you have to assess. Now, the metrics part of that is each one of those who, what, how, why, when, where's is attached to a metric of what we use as dates and dollars. When will the project be ready? Here's a date. What's the dollar attached to that project? How much time do I need to spend to get that client to the finish line? If it's a $10,000 item or if it's a $300,000 item, it doesn't matter, right? We told someone recently that they needed to have a commissioned sculpture in their stairwell, not a chandelier.
Oh, so you said you don't need one of our products. You need a different solution for that.
Exactly.
Question. Right.
And so as we look at that, the who, what, how, why, when, where answers those questions and distilled down to the job site from curbside to poolside. That's another ADG, term that we use, curbside to poolside. What are we going to do for you? Starting at the curb.
Okay, so you're doing landscape lighting as well, not just interior lighting.
Exactly. So I have
that's how that landscape experience in the beginning came back. So
yes.
I could see your work at the pool. I could see your work at the curb.
Yes, exactly. We have a project right now where this, the one Beverly Hills one, 2.5 acres, was a let's just say around the $26 million house, right? That way they can't Google it. But this other one that I'm working on in Malibu, which I have an NDA on as well, is a $26 million, 4,000 square foot postage stamp.
Well,
the approach is the same, curbside to poolside. There's just more stuff on the larger property. On the smaller property, as we bring it to the curb, it's let's do this beautiful gas lantern on your mailbox pedestal, because that actually engages you instantly when you're walking up to the home, and then you have all the elements, fire and water and, earth, wind, fire, here at the beach. So we're starting out in the progression into the home and then looking at all of the other details. There's this beautiful millwork. It's an older home. I mean, it was built in the 60s in Malibu, and the eave detail is so gorgeous. The millwork is wonderful. And I'm like, don't you dare punctuate that with can lights. Don't you
pot lights.
So we have this beautiful 1/2 inch by 1/2 inch bronze light that we're just going to just hold right up into the millwork. It's like 10 inches long. And so you're complementing what's there without destroying it. In today's market, everyone wants to Swiss cheese every ceiling. And that's again, where I'll come in and say, no, I'm going to tell you my thoughts. If you don't like that, and in the back of my head, I have who, what, how, why, when, where. If you don't like that, tell me what your needs are, and then I'm going to develop something that you like.
Okay. Have you ever, I mean, in these uber wealthy clients, have you ever turned down business and said, I can't do what you want?
I did actually. One home in Beverly Park, I turned down. A client had asked if I could make a particular light, which was what I just did for Bill Hlebinski. And again, it's a good reference home. I mean, this was this beautiful Italian fortress with, you know, internal courtyards. They had the most incredible French deco collection of art and furnishings. And everything we did was to the, you know, nth degree. And another homeowner, which if I said his name, everyone would know who this person is. So I won't say his name. But he says, I want that. I'm like, no, but I want that. I understand you want that, but I can't give you that. Well, but that's what I want. And I realized it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And the designer was just as persnickety. And I said, thank you very much. And as one home I turned down all those years ago because it just wasn't right. And it had nothing to do with the money. The money would have been wonderful, but it had to do with the integrity of elevating the essence of architecture. That hashtag.
So you're sticking to your values.
Right.
Build. Like you've got values that you represent. There's what you'll stand for and what you won't. And for some reason, these guys together were something you weren't going to stand for.
Exactly. And it's okay. You know, you win some, you lose some, as they say, but I have enough wins. And by the way, another good takeaway, I have enough failures to tell people what doesn't work.
Uh-oh.
So why would you want to tell me you know better when I can say, but this doesn't work? I'll tell you why it doesn't work. Now, if you want to go repeat that failure, and that happens with salespeople as you're expanding your business.
Right.
No one's going to do it the way you do it, but it's transferable to say, this is what we do. Here's the ADG advantage. This is how we do it.
Mm.
And I've had some people in recent years tell me they know more, and that's great. Prove it. And then complain when they fail.
You just brought up a really interesting point. I had a question, but I think you just brought up a more important one. As we grow as business owners, we need to bring on a team.
Yes.
In order to bring on that team, they have to kind of understand the client and understand the client's needs. Let me go off to the side for a second and come back. There's times when I'm at the airport and I go to buy a sandwich before I get on the plane, and the lady behind the counter says, are you sure it's $12?
Right.
And the reason she says that is because she can't imagine spending $12 or $13 on like a ham and cheese sandwich. I can't either, but I got to get on this plane.
And you're hungry.
And I'm hungry, right? But she's putting her impression of the price of this food in her mind. She's like, why didn't you just bring it from home, buddy? Well, because I'm on my third stop to get to Austin, Texas or something. I have to eat. So I'm going to come now back to the question. You're probably hiring people that didn't grow up in Bing Crosby's house. I'm making that name up just because he's famous and he's now passed on. So you probably can't get mad at me. So how do you hire people who don't come from that reality? How do you train them on the ADG advantage so that they can represent you properly in the field? That might be the question we've summarized down today. How do you
So money isn't that advantage. Okay. We, a colleague of mine who's a phenomenal millworks guy, right? I mean, old school, all of his drawings actually show the joinery. Okay.
Oh.
It's pretty awesome. And he said one time, he says, Gerald, it takes a lot of money to fuck up a good house. Yeah, it's like old school guy from Chicago, you know, and I'm like, all right, I got it, Virgil. That's awesome. And I recognize that it's not the money part and growing up as uber elite. What it is having that good education. Our senior project manager comes from a great story background. His dad is an immigrant, came to this country with nothing, worked hard, built up something wonderful. What he taught his son was, and he has a landscape business, so he taught his son, hey, look, if you're digging and you break a pipe, you need to go tell the owner, hey, broke a pipe, I'm going to fix this today, but I just want to let you know what's going on. Okay. You cannot teach that skill set. And what we realize in our interview process now is that part of the question has to come out. How were you influenced? What were those types of engagement?
What was your kitchen table like?
Exactly. The same thing is my wife asked that we put on the interview questions. Did you ever play a team sport?
I love it.
Now, golf is not a team sport. However, golf is about some serious discipline. But you instantly can gauge how that person is going to respond with other people. You know, I was in band. I was a cheerleader. Okay, that's great. What does that do? I was on the football team. You know, I sat on the bench, but I was on the team. Okay, great. We begin to learn more about individuals and those types of questions. And right. She's our COO. So she wants to make sure that side is going to be taken care of as we're, you know, engaging
with crafting the team. She's crafting the team.
Exactly. Right. And it's brilliant because we recognize instantly a difference in personalities and skill sets. And right now, as we have a request out there to have salespeople, and there are commission salespeople we're asking for.
Yeah.
And I have a flood of resumes, and going through these, it's very interesting. We're not discounting someone if they don't have construction experience or sales experience in our industry. We're really taking a deeper dive now to try to understand what these people are. And from that, again, how you grew up, silver spooners are not necessarily the best.
No.
For our needs, that is. They might be the best clients, but they might not be the best workforce.
And so you're asking those questions. You're trying to find out. And I say this too. I shouldn't have to teach you what I think you should have learned at the kitchen table. But that's my perspective of the kitchen table. For another company, that might be different.
It is. It's very different. Look, we're a mom and pop shop, as we say. We are.
A little bit of shine. You're a shiny mom and pop shop.
We are. You know, we've weathered through all the financial crises, kept our factory doors open, kept people employed. Through COVID this last year, we were very busy. And I'm not going to say it's because we were dealing in the upper end, but I'm going to say it's because we were prepared. We've been prepared for every twist and turn in this business. And that goes to the planning stage of what can we do? How can we do it? When do we need to do it? What do we need to do?
The entrepreneur question.
Where?
Yeah.
And you go back to that repetitively. And I think your audience, print it out, you know, on a piece of paper, make it beautiful on a plaque, however your audience would like, and put it to the wall. We have that posted through the multiple offices here at our design studios. We have what the ADG advantage is, again, elevating the essence of architecture through design and fabrication of lighting and furnishing with our collections through the centuries. What that says is how we cover that who, what, how, why, when, where. I even have dates and dollars framed, the word dates and dollars, and that's framed going throughout the offices as well.
So you're also pulling together the culture. This is the culture of ADG, like what it looks like internally, how we think, how we act. When Gerald's not in the room, I have to ask about dates and dollars, or I have to think about dates and dollars.
You have to, because when you come to a home that is so personal, right? Most of these people, it's their home. Doesn't matter if it's 2 million, 20 million, you know, 80 million. 95 million is the most expensive home I did, which was the old Disney estate where his train yard was.
Oh, wow.
Bel Air. The value of that is it's their home. Now, when it's a spec builder, it's their money.
Yeah.
So you still have to approach it with the same respect. It's theirs. It's not yours. Mm. However, the level of expertise that you bring to the table, the influence is there.
Oh my God.
Designers are a different business model these days. And I will say that designers have a very different approach. Architects have an approach that is very much the leadership. They're creating. And I remember in school, they had a course. It was like, act like an asshole. You're the God 101 architecture. No.
That's almost like that.
Almost like that. But that's okay because they're creating this level. But what we found is the ones that are really good at that level that we have dealt with don't have that godlike complex. And again, want to engage guys like a Bob White or a Richard Krantz that get down to the layering and the detail and then come back and have the dialogue. Well, how would you put the lighting in? What would you do? And we look at that interplay. And when you do, you have such a great opportunity. Or if you're dealing with like National GmbH or Rutt, and you're dealing with the dealer, they want that level of millwork to be at its finest in this, you know, kitchen, bathroom, hallway, entryway, library, and so everything you have to do has to pair with it.
Yeah,
and so you have to understand then what's going on with that level of detail in the home and be able to predict, hey, wait a moment, if you're going to do this and this is going in, how is that going to affect what we're going to do? And it's just as important.
Yeah. It's amazing. You know, you just said something a moment ago about the builders. Mm-hmm. And it's their money. Like a spec home builder where you live is taking some serious risks, as spec homes often are, building a home, you know, for a couple tens of millions of dollars. But what you said there was interesting because I had another guest on a couple of weeks ago. His name's Fernando Pajes Ruiz. Mm-hmm. Wonderful guy, very wise and intelligent. I don't know if you know him. He's in Southern California as well. But he also says, it's my home. He's an He builds economical homes.
Right.
So we've got two completely different sides of the spectrum, but you guys both just said the same thing. This is my home because he's a builder. The guy who's building the spec home in Bel Air, it's my home. And they both, you're both talking about it with the same level of care. It doesn't matter how many zeros or commas are in the conversation.
No, it doesn't. It really is about what is theirs. And so that intention and the respect, again, elevating the essence of architecture, is so important. We had a job recently that we didn't get. The mm-hmm. designer brought us in a spec home in Hidden Hills. And this young guy who's a UCLA grad teamed up with some other people and they're building this house and they're selling it at $12 million. And we said, look, you really need to change what you're doing with the lighting. It doesn't balance properly. You can use this term modern farmhouse, which is just a gross term because it's not what it is. They're just slapping a label and, you know, calling it something. And I said, look, the scale of the architecture does not balance with the scale of what you're doing with your lighting. Huh. I know you have a budget, but this is what I'm going to recommend, how we rebalance everything. And the young man looks at my project manager. And he says, what do you think? I have to sell my shoes to afford what you do? It's only a $12 million house. They won't know the difference. And we walked away and I said, you know what? That's someone we don't want to do business with anyway. Because at $12 million, there's no level of respect. $12 million and he's pulling the wool over people's eyes. Just don't put any lights in the house. We, you know, don't put the toilets in either. Don't, you know, just give them a shell and just say, here.
Yeah.
Why are you wasting material? Why are you wasting someone else's effort? Why are you wasting resources? Why are you wasting the designer's time? And at the end of the day, those are people we don't want to work with because they are actually causing this devaluation of what should be a fine aesthetic. And at $12 million, you can either feed a lot of people or house a lot of people. And so the one person who's buying it, why should they rip anything out? And of all the homes I've done in Beverly Park, when I drove through the other day, after 27 years, every single home on the front of them and their gates and everywhere else still had the same lights that I had penned. And I could remember what I did, where I did,
wow,
and how I penned those things and who I was with. Every one of them was a memory.
Interesting. That's an interesting attitude that goes, you know, that gentleman you're talking about, that builder who said, do I have to sell my shoes? If I'm understanding correctly, he's exactly the opposite of the kind of the person you would hire in your company to sell to these people. Because a $12 million home is, it's an estate, a mansion, anywhere.
And you know, the level of respect towards who his buyer is as well. All right, well, if you can't afford what I do, you're in the wrong business. Because what I do is make what you do look better.
Yeah, it might be because he's young and new and he doesn't understand lighting. I mean, I openly don't understand lighting. You've talked about beautiful millwork. We have so many millworkers listening to this show. It would probably make your head spin. Guys who really understand joinery and fine fittings and actually installing it properly to make the job look good. And sometimes they're called in and they say, oh, throw some puck lights in that.
Yeah.
Oh, that probably makes you, I could just, your face just changed so much. Sorry. Yeah. But that's what they say. Oh, we'll just throw some LEDs under there. And
well, you know, with respect to the good designers, they'll understand this statement when we make it. We walk into a project and here, you know, this guy or gal is, you know, taking this fine walnut, there's not an ounce of laminate in there. You know, they've ripped everything down. They've got this beautiful, you know, library that they're building. And then the designer says, you know, well, we want some sconces on there. So just cut a, you know, hole in for the J box. You're going, you're cutting a 3-inch diameter hole in that. No, you're killing the lines of everything too. You have to look at it. So we want them to know, like, come in early. I'll make some specialty little makeup box. It's the tiniest little thing that integrates so we can do all the wiring. And you get this beautiful style. And then, you know, scutcheon going down it and it interfaces. That's the way it should be done. Respecting the person who made the stuff.
Yeah.
And let everyone kind of go through. But today with the internet, everyone just wants to clickety clickety click click click. Oh, I found this thing and I'm going to put it on, without understanding that someone went through the effort to make the other part. Those that do, we appreciate. Those that don't, we try to educate. But again, I wore bags in the beginning so I'd learn how to build the house.
Love it. This has been such an incredible interview, because the things that you talk about, actually, you know, we're talking about the super wealthy, beyond wealthiness that we would understand, you know, writing a check for a $12 million house, or in reality, qualifying for the mortgage for a $12 million house, which is the least expensive of all the properties you talked about today, by the way, is outside the range for so many people. But the way you've talked about it is approachable for everybody. It, you know, respect everybody in the process, listen carefully to the people around you, but also hold firm when you know that your expertise is called for at that time. You know, there's times when you take the lead.
Absolutely. And if you have something that's not a $12 million, it's a $1.2 million, it's a $300,000 home, right?
Just depends on the market.
It just depends on where you are, but it also depends on what you have and what you can find that works. The other day I was, you know, looking at our home, and some friends call it the biggest little house I've ever seen, because it's how we interact within our own property. And we have, you know, doors everywhere so that you can go into courtyards on the side and back and forth and circulate through the property and up the hill and down the hill. We just named it recently Cottage Lumiere.
This is your house.
This is my house.
Cottage Lumiere.
And you know, the kind of essence of that is when you walk up, you know, through the garden and come up, you know, the first lantern that's there was from this project that I did with Bob White. And it reminds me of, you know, the integration of all of this detail, because Bob is a phenomenal architectural designer doing, you know, layers and layers of materials. And it was the first time I had developed a lantern that sat in the landscape. And that's the way we draw people through these yards. You get up to my front door and the lantern is from Todd Phillips from The Hangover. It's from his Malibu estate when I redid the lights on that. And I kept this one old crusty, rusty falling apart, but in Malibu on the water, that's not so good. But where we live, you know, we kind of restored it and it sits prominently on the wall. Yeah. But as you move through it, I do have the crown element, which was this chandelier I did for my wife, but that was inspired by this artisanal piece that I did for one of the top appellate court attorneys in the country. And his home was far bigger and the piece was far larger, but rescaled and redetailed, you know, for our house.
Yeah.
Then sitting within this other sitting room are the sconces that I had helped Michael Smith develop for his original lighting line, which they're steel and bronze castings and just kind of cool pieces. And sitting in there is this table for Michael Berman, who Michael Berman is one of the most respected interior designers, such a gentleman and incredible talent. But I got to actually private label and make his furnishing line when he didn't like the person who was making his furniture anymore. And that's how I got into the furniture business. So these memories, right? As we go through, you go into the kitchen and I just sold the chandelier that was in there because it was an ode to an old Italian designer. But the piece that I replaced it is from Armand Marciano's home, and that's Guest Jeans, right? So then
there's a lot of stories wandering through.
There's a lot of stories, and you keep moving through, and you know, you look up to the hillside, and I have this great piece that came from Michael Eisner's home, and you know, it's just this collection. I have Liz Hearn. No one knows who Liz Hearn is, but Michael's stores where you get the crafts and arts supplies.
Right.
This piece sitting in my garden from Liz. And then I had this other piece sitting in my garden from Hendricks and Allardyce when I used to make their lighting line. And so this collection is so important to how you live that it doesn't mean like all these pieces are phenomenal pieces, right? But the personality that comes through, whether it was that $12 million house that the guy, you know, didn't want to put anything in, right, or someone who has a 300,000 or, you know, home that's even less. Take those pieces that are personal, make them your own, but understand how they integrate into the architecture. And it's not, I don't use them just because, you know, it's, you know, attached to these famous, you know, homes.
They work. You do have the choice of lots of pieces, but you chose those pieces.
Of lots of them or making it all anew. But the idea is, how do you begin to tell that story? What's the development? How do you want to wake up in the morning? What do you want to feel? What makes you get up and go? And then how do you translate that into your daily habits?
Wow. One day we're going to have you back to talk about your manufacturing floor, because we didn't touch on that at all. You're doing bespoke custom stuff, which is very similar to lots of people here. I imagine you do glass blowing, you do steel, you probably have some electrical work you're doing there, I would imagine.
Love walnut. Love working with walnut.
Let's bring you back for a different angle on this, because you're a great storyteller and I'd love to hear it.
And maybe when Canada lets, you know, U.S. citizens back in over the border to visit, just come in, we'll sit side by side and do it.
It's the same both ways. I want to come to your house and I want to have a glass of wine. And by the way, for me, just because you deal with the wealthy, wine to me, I would rather have cheap wine with people I like than expensive wine with people I don't like. Does that make sense?
It does.
The kind of wine my dad makes, we call it Merlot de Pied.
Yeah.
Port wine. But what? I love it. I love it. The first glass is a little tough to take, but after that, it settles right in.
Right, right.
I would rather have that wine with people I enjoy than some snooty high-priced wine. Anyways, perhaps one day we'll get a chance to visit there when the borders open up, and they will.
And then I'll tell you the wine story of the wine.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, of course.
Of course I do.
Of course. Hey, Gerald, if somebody wants to find out about you or more about the ADG Advantage, how do we find you in the world?
So we have made ourselves hopefully very Googleable, whether it's our furnishing line, architectural ornament, or lighting. You can go to adglighting.com. If you want to just jump to my story, you can type in geraldolesker.com, see the bio and background. I also have two books out, one called Muse, XOGEO, which was a compilation of 25 years of my sketchbooks. So it has some writings, some notes, some diagrams and renderings. It fits in the back of your blue jean pocket because I think we need that, not the cell phone in our pocket. Yeah. The other book is called Networking with the Cards You're Dealt. Happen to be the illustrator for that. My forum mate from EO had written the book. He took his company up to $100 million. And it uses poker, Texas Hold'em, as the way to network and engage with people. It shares stories. We shared Michael Eisner as a client in common. So there's a great little story and rendering with Michael at when he was the CEO of Disney, and other stories like that. Great books, both available on Amazon for a shameless plug. But the opportunity to really learn more, our doors are always open. We love working with, you know, new tradespeople all over the world, our Canadian neighbors down south and everywhere else.
And, yeah. Lots of international listeners too. We've got lots of people from Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England.
We're shipping some things to Australia right now. And, you know, the container is, you know, less expensive than all of the stuff going in it, but it's still, you know, a huge, huge order. And we wanted to know why. And they said, because we can't get this in Australia. I was blown away. I didn't know that.
But what, they can't get your type of work?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, I was honored. So I'm like, great. You know, that's an expensive place to ship to, but, you know, we're more than glad to do that. Saudi Arabia, we've done, and England, Korea, all over. So it's, Yeah, it's a small community in the upper end community.
Yeah. Well, there's so many other questions I want to ask you. And again, maybe we'll bring you back because I've got more questions on my page here. We didn't even get to them, but thank you. I appreciate your time. And thanks to everybody for listening in. This is because you get to deal with some people that we don't even know exist.
And any one of your audience members has a question, just feel free to, again, Google me out and you can ping me from our website.
All right. Gerald, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us here today.
I appreciate it. Cheers.
Have a great day. Thanks. Bye.
Well, Gerald, great job. That was a really interesting look and a wide-ranging look at everything that goes on with selling to these super elite, super wealthy people. And what's interesting is they're not all that different than, as I mentioned, I'd done an episode with Fernando. His full name is Fernando Pajes Ruiz. And some of you will recognize him from his affordable home building books on Amazon. Really talking about the same thing. Doing what's right for the customer that lines up with the customer's expectations. And so I'm going to ask you this as a business coaching question. Are you lining up your products and services with your customer's expectations? If you're not, which one of those two is off? Are the customer's expectations off? Well, if that's the case, then you have to market to a different or better or different kind of customer. Or you have to change your internal operations to line up with their expectations. One of those two has to change, right? And so it's never static. There's always a little bit of fluctuation, but you have to understand first who you are, what your, we call it a value proposition, but what makes you different in the market. Don't tell me you're a roofer like everybody else. Don't tell me you're a cabinet maker like everybody else. Don't tell me you do forms and foundations or framing like everybody else. There's something that makes you different. Let's line that up with the right kind of market. It doesn't have to be a fancy market like Gerald was talking about. It just has to be the right offer for the right market so you can stay as busy as you want, as profitable as you want. Remember, please remember, you started this business, you call the shots. Or let me say this in the positive, I started this business, I get to call the shots. And so if you're not getting the results you want from the market, it's up to you or it's up to me to change those results by changing the inputs. So that's one of the takeaways I took from Gerald here today. Some really good insight. I like that question that we started talking about, which was if your people are selling to the super wealthy, but the people you hire aren't super wealthy themselves, how do they get their head wrapped around selling to them? And so I really like Gerald's input on that, what he looks for. That conversation around the kitchen table. You guys have heard me talk about that before. You read about it in the book, The Construction Millionaire Secrets. There's that story about Doug. Doug and I literally sitting at the kitchen counter because we've got to go take a load of junk to the dump in my trailer. And Doug's talking to his son about this, not a bake sale. What was it? They're selling cookies. That kind of conversation at the kitchen table, at the kitchen counter, you don't think you're teaching your kids anything about the future, but you're giving them a new way to think. By listening to this show, by reading books, by being part of this community, you're lining yourself up in a way that is either going to make you successful or the next generation successful. You're setting other people up around you for success. And so I like the way that Gerald said, well, he goes back to look at their kitchen table to see if the conversation they had when they were kids growing up was the kind of conversation they'd be comfortable having today with the people who are wealthy beyond wealth. So anyways, I hope you took that away. I hope you had a great experience with that episode. Stay tuned. We've got story time with Dom coming up. I know you're going to love it. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Story Time with Dom. Today, we're going to talk about a guy who's got a shop. He does sheet metal and cladding, right? So he bends, he's got breaking machines, he does sheet metal and all that stuff. Tinsmiths. For those of you in Australia, I think you call them pinnies. That's a shout out to my friend, Dan Zambello, who's now helping me run the contractor strategy group on Facebook. Dan, tell me if tinny's the right word. Who knows what an actual nickname is. Anyways, this guy runs a sheet metal shop and cladding. One of the things that I put in place with him is something you might be able to do in your business as well. It's just that you got to do something first before you get the benefit of what I'm about to talk about. And the thing that we did in that company is we put something in place called the end of job report. I think you guys have heard me talk about this before, because I talk about it a lot. If you're a fan of reading articles, you may have read the article I wrote for Forbes magazine called The Leprechaun Report. And I had to make up the name Leprechaun Report from what my client called it many, many years ago. And some of you know the backstory, but Forbes calls me when they need a funny article done about something boring. So I don't know why they call me, but and so they're like, Dominic, we're doing this St. Patrick's Day story. It's going to run on St. Patrick's Day. Can you give us something about business that relates to St. Patrick's Day? And I'm like, what? Well, I'm not in the bar business, so I don't know what I'm going to do. So anyways, I racked my brain. And I remember years and years and years ago, I had a client who called the end of job report the Leprechaun Report, because he said he found the pot of gold in it, where he found his profit. Anyways, if you're in the situation that these guys were in, they do sheet metal and cladding. And I'm like, listen, we got to do an end of job report. So they bid on commercial projects, not so much residential. I suppose if they're doing some venting for a larger home, they would do some venting, but a lot of that stuff is off the shelf. Anyways, so we started to do end of job reports. So after they did a job, let's say for a new restaurant that went into a strip mall, they would go back and look at the profitability report. And they realized some jobs were less profitable than others. Surprise, surprise. And some jobs were more profitable than others. And as we started to look at it, one of the things that jumped out is something you've heard me say here before. Those of you who are in the Construction Millionaire Challenge or do one-on-one coaching with me are already familiar with what I'm going to say next. It was, stuck behind the train, toll booths, bridges, tough places to drive to, because they found that they were getting stuck on long drive times. Now, long doesn't mean far away necessarily. Long just means it takes it's hard to get there. And in some cases, some of you might be dealing with condos or apartments in cities where there's lots of parking tickets. And so parking outside that building, you're going to get a parking ticket. Well, that adds to the cost. It's what, 60, 80 bucks every time, right? And your guys go on that site 4 days to do the job. So 4 times 80, you're losing a couple hundred bucks right there. So is that the right place to do business? Now, I'm not saying not to do business in places that are too long to get to, too far away, or cost you to get in front of. I'm just saying you have to adjust your pricing or make the decision to go there or not go there, right? So it's your decision. There's always this great spot in town, right? The nicest neighborhood that everybody wants to get to. But if you've got to pay a toll to get there, or if you're stuck in traffic for 2 hours just to get there, is it worth it? Because two of your guys in one van for 1 hour or 2 hours costs you money.
money that you're probably not able to gather back from the sale price. Leave that for somebody else. Go find more profitable work in another part of town, right? But the only way you can do that is by having the end of job report so that the numbers are just laid out there in front of you. Numbers don't lie. Numbers don't have anything against you. They're just numbers. They just sit there. They're just reality. You've heard me say it before. Numbers are cold, but talking about numbers is hot. I actually say that about money, but it's the same thing, right? Numbers just tell the truth. And so look at your numbers after a job is done. Yes, I know it takes extra work. Yes, I know it's kind of a hassle. Yes, I know you hate meetings. And yet I keep suggesting the same thing. Why are we having this battle? One that I'm not going to stop having, because I want you to have what you need to have, which is get the key numbers on your jobs so you can make the decisions. So these guys that do sheet metal started to figure out anyways that they the really simple system, I know you guys are a fan of simple systems. The simple system we put in place is that they have a pricing map. It's literally a map on the wall. And there's zone one, zone two, and zone three. And it's easy to think about it if you think their shop is right in the center, and then zone one is a circle around them. It's not actually a circle. There's a little triangle taken out of it where there's a tough part to get to because of a railway yard. Once that train goes through there, the train just parks and you're stuck behind it and you can't really turn around. So they cut this divot out of zone one. Anyways, there's zone one, there's zone two, and then zone three is this wonky looking thing that looks like a liver that a doctor might remove. But you get my point. They've gone and modified the map so it looks the way they want. And they know how to price for zone one, zone two, and zone three. So they make a decision. Are we going to take that deal in zone three? Yes, we are. But we're going to price it like this. So they don't end up, the owner doesn't end up eating what's supposed to be profits. All right, there you go. That's the world of a sheet metal guy and how he does his pricing to make sure he stays profitable. I hope you enjoyed story time with Dom. That's a kind of a good story. I forgot to tell you about the owner. Very, very good guy. Always got a smile on his face. Man, that guy has got a beard you wouldn't believe. Like, that beard would make anybody proud. But he's always got a smile on his face. He's a good guy. He's got a very good crew. And I know it took him a long time to get to the place where he's at right now, where he's got a foreman he can trust and a crew of people he can trust. And a lot of us don't have what he's got. But he's done a great job of building that company. He's just looking for ways to make it a little bit better all the time. Listen, if you're ready to challenge your business, maybe you should join the Construction Millionaire Challenge with me, with us. If you want to do that, send me a text message. Just send the keyword challenge to me at 604-837-8361. Have a great day, folks. We'll talk to you soon.